From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This week on Soundings, excerpts from conversations with two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. They are Madeline Gutworth of Westchester University and Marcel Gutworth of Haverford College. During her fellowship year at the center, Madeline Gutworth worked on a forthcoming book about the role of women in the French Revolution. Marcel Gutworth worked on a book about theories and functions of comedy. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Madeline Gutworth of Westchester University. According to Madeline Gutworth, the political revolution in 18th century France enacted an earlier but related artistic revolution, in which women exerted a limited influence in official French society, but were denied complete social enfranchisement. In her work about women and the French Revolution, Madeline Gutworth sets forth two important terms, gynocentrism and virocentrism.
Well, I use these terms primarily as indicators. That is, they're descriptions of the locus of men or women in various works of art. That is, it has often been said that in the 18th century, women ruled. Madame Vigée-Lebrun, for example, says that in her memoirs. And the Goncourt in their 19th century study on women in the 18th century say that it was the century of women. Mm-hmm. And I think what they mean by that is that in the high Rococo art of the 18th century court, women are at the center. And of course, they're at the center of sexual concern. They're also at the center of sexual concern in the novels of the period, where in the novel of seduction, it is the seduction of a woman that is the core of the story. Uh-huh. And so that's really what I mean by that. Now, I use the term virocentrism in contrast to characterize neoclassical art, where the hero, of course, is a male who is commemorated for his great deeds or his wisdom. Mm-hmm. And so I just use these two terms in that way as a kind of point of departure.
Can we reduce it, or can we talk for a moment about the ideology of gender? That is to say, who is in control and under what, in your instance here, Madeline Gutworth, would be artistic circumstances?
Well,
do I have that right?
Yes. Well, I think that certainly the men are in control. Uh-huh. And there is no doubt in my mind that what we're dealing with is always a male culture, and even as today, I think we still live in a male culture.
Primarily. So we're not looking back at a sort of golden age here in terms of women and art.
No, but I think that what we are looking at is a mixed culture in terms of gender, and of course, that's really the kernel of what I'm thinking about here. That is, before the French Revolution, and everyone has noticed this, women had a species of power and a species of influence. They were not powers, they were not the ultimate powers, but they were brokers in the salon. They could push people ahead or hold people back. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Rétif de la Bretonne says in his, or I think it's Mercier, not Rétif, says a young man who goes to Paris has to find a powerful woman to be his protector. Mm-hmm. So you can see that women play that kind of intermediary role, even in circles that were not the top circles mm-hmm. of the time. Mm-hmm. In the great salons of the time of Madame du Deffand, Madame Necker, you would find that there were many little salons that followed after the model of these great salon women. So I think that even though they're not numerous, they are influential. And of course, I'm also interested, I suppose, just on the human plane, mm-hmm. in social history, in the social history of the period, and what all the women of the period are experiencing. And that's one of the most interesting things that I observe here. It is the tremendous gap between the official culture and the very, very rustic and backward culture of the countryside.
Uh-huh. Was this a question of education? Was it a question of rising socially because of one's financial status?
Well, because you're still living here, in a you still have here a culture that is hereditary,
uh-huh.
and where people are born into their station. And of course, that's what the French Revolution is largely about. Uh-huh.
Madeleine Gutworth, our topic is French culture in the 18th century. Give me a sense of what political circumstances, or how about the church? Was there a relationship between art and religion at this time period? Maybe let's begin with politics. Can you generalize there for me?
Is there a relationship between art and politics? Well, of course, what I'm interested in here is the change between Rococo art, or the alteration that comes about as between the Rococo art and the rise of the neoclassical art at the end of the 18th century. And that comes about around the 1770s,
mm-hmm.
and progresses through the Revolution. In a sense, that's political, but nothing can be political in the 18th century because you're living in a monarchy where there is no freedom of expression. Voltaire had to have his books published in Holland,
mm-hmm.
So that you have to say what you're saying politically by occult means.
Madeleine Gutworth, how does all of this connect back to your interest in women and art in the 18th century? Are we talking about questions of equity? Are we talking about questions of what today would be called power sharing? That is to say, the way men and women define the ground rules by which they live?
I think we're rather talking about the double standard.
Uh-huh.
I think that...
Let's get right to it.
That's right. Uh-huh. I think that basically, before the revolution, there is a very strong sense, and I think this is sort of common coin, that the 18th century is a licentious period.
Mm-hmm.
The form of this licentiousness has been documented. I mean, one sees it in these illegitimacies. It's been explained in part, the increase in illegitimacy has been explained in part by the fact that people were coming up from the towns to the cities, or from the villages, really, to the cities.
And here's this rustic urban tension.
That's right. And, of course, this is a very, very important schism in the 18th century mentality, that
uh-huh.
is the wicked city as against the innocent country. And, of course, one finds that especially in the works of Rousseau.
Uh-huh.
And as people try to grapple with city mores, with prostitution, with the fact that they cannot help their own infants to survive, in fact, Rousseau himself, as you know, gave out his five children to a nursing home to be taken care of. So I believe that this is not an uncommon pattern at all. In fact, it's a major pattern, and I think that it's a hidden aspect of the 18th century mentality. That is, that men who engendered children could not then, through the mores and also through the fault of the economic system, help those children to survive.
Mm-hmm. Madeleine Gutworth, we're talking about the relations between men and women in 18th century French culture. Would you take any solace at all in the fact that you can point to an individual such as Madame de Staël, who has an enormous artistic and continuing influence into the 19th century? I don't know what the literary critics today would say. It used to be fashionable to point to one or two figures and say, here is somebody who helped what? Create, or here we have somebody at the wellsprings of a large cultural notion such as Romanticism. Now, there you have what? A very great step forward, set in contrast to these small incremental social steps that you've been describing.
Well, Madame de Staël is really a wonderful example of what I'm really referring to here, because she is the daughter of a prime minister, the last prime minister of Louis XVI.
That would be about when? Just give me a sense of the time period here.
In the 1780s.
Okay.
In fact, it was the firing of her father that really occasioned the storming of the Bastille.
Uh-huh.
And she had a very active interest in politics and was very ambitious politically, in a sense, even for herself, one might say, but never conceived of herself as a political person, at least not consciously. She espoused a view of women which would have indicated that they stay in their role as power brokers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it is very interesting to think that she wrote a work of politics in the 1790s, which was never published until the 20th century, because it was not deemed wise for a woman to publish a work on politics.
Would you reduce this to a crude word like oppression? Why did that happen?
Well, oppression, of course, always seems to us to be something overt. I think the oppression of women is in our mores. I think it continues in a subtle way. It's really lifted a great deal. But I think we still have elements of it today.
Apropos of that, Madeleine Gutworth, our topic is the relations between men and women in the 18th century. Do you find contemporary pertinences in what you are looking at? Do you find, as you unravel these threads and tease them out, do you find connections, direct and indirect, between those social and artistic circumstances and the ones that we live in the 20th century?
I don't find direct consonances between the two worlds. I think the reason I'm interested in my work is that I am interested in the nexus of feelings that underlie gender relations and how these are expressed in our art. And of course, the kind of return to domesticity that one has at the end of the 18th century is a kind of return to a kind of pleasant patriarchal fold.
And I take it that you wouldn't be happy with that, that again would reinforce what, this double standard that you have described?
Well, I think that the domestic idol is charming. Everyone finds it charming.
Except the women who have to do the drudgery, right?
Exactly. And I think that it's the division of the two spheres that occurs at the end of the 18th century and that we carry on to a certain extent even now, that has been decisive in the problems that women have had getting a toehold in the public realm, as we've seen recently in the case of Geraldine Ferraro.
Well, maybe you've answered my final question here, but let me put it to you nevertheless. Madeleine Gutworth, our topic has been men and women, art and culture in the 18th century in France. Are you an optimist? Judging from the evidence that you are sifting through here, do you think that we are moving, inching forward ahead, however slowly and incrementally, in figuring out how men should treat women and vice versa?
Well, of course I'm an optimist because we've made a great deal of progress since the French Revolution. But I do think that there is an underlying question that we have failed to pose, and I think it's almost a question of human evolution. I regard the way culture views women as a product of the evolution of the human mentality. And so I have a very long view of it. I don't think that things will change overnight.
Madeleine Gutworth is a professor of French at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Madeleine Gutworth worked on a forthcoming book about women, art, and society during the French Revolution. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with an excerpt from a conversation with another scholar at the center. Marcel Gutworth of Haverford College worked during his fellowship year on a project describing and integrating various theories and functions of comedy, including literary, historical, and anthropological formulations. According to Marcel Gutworth, comedy is paradoxical, combining the emotions and the intellect, distance and intimacy at personal and social levels, and laughter and earnestness. Here is Marcel Gutworth.
To begin with, there is a vast literature of theory of laughter, theory of the comic, too vast to exhaust. And on the other hand, those who deal with comedy, who teach comedy aren't necessarily acquainted with the theoretical material. But basically, one starts in the approved scholarly manner by going back to the Greeks, going back to Aristotle, Plato, going back to Hobbes, Kant, going back to the classical formulations of the problem.
To look at these problems historically, Marcel Gutworth, are you telling me that people laughed at different things in different societies? Or are we looking at the same human motives? Are we talking about cultural differences or psychological differences? Help me make some distinctions here.
Let me perhaps give you an example. The Elizabethans thought it excruciatingly funny to beat a bear. This would only horrify us.
Bear baiting, they
call
it.
Bear baiting, right. Exactly. That's not the only example one could cite of cultural differences. The difference is not a difference in makeup or in the nature of laughter, but in the values assigned to animals, for instance, in a particular culture. What we mean by humor, for instance, tends to be a laughter tinged with emotion. And the ability, the sense of humor, is the ability to laugh at oneself and to include oneself into the picture. When Freud speaks of humor, which is the German equivalent, and in fact in German and in French, in continental usage, humor tends more to be characterized by what we call gallows humor, that is a reaction to an extreme threat, a humorous reaction, the ability to laugh in the face of danger, in the face of death. And so, in terms of even distinctions among such subcategories as irony, wit, grotesque, the comic, we don't have a nomenclature that is foolproof. One of the cautions in dealing with, in fact, any subject is the temptation to raise your subject to a kind of ideal. And that temptation is very strong in terms of the sense of humor.
There's another irony here. You're telling me that you don't want to take your book about laughter too seriously.
Precisely.
Right.
Or at least that one wants to retain a sense of the ambivalence and the ambiguity of the phenomenon. It is easy to idealize the sense of humor and to see it as an heroic outlook, which it can be, but it also can be great awfulness. The fact that the Elizabethan laughed at cripples and bears does not preclude the fact that Nazis laugh at their victims, the tormentors laugh at the writhing of human beings and their sufferings. So, laughter can be heroic, can be noble, can be enhancing. But it is an uncontrollable phenomenon. It is an anarchic dimension of the human psyche.
Well, this is a rather dark side here that you are telling me about, which is actually very unpleasant. Not what we would associate with comedy or laughter.
There is one theoretician makes a distinction between what he calls crude laughter, the phenomenon itself, and educated laughter or aesthetic laughter. I don't accept that. I think that the phenomenon is indeed a threatening one, but it is threatening in as much as it is an expression on a representative of our freedom, of our ability to break loose, of break free, of even highly valued constraints.
Marcel Gutworth, we're talking about your investigations into a theory of laughter, comedy, comic wisdom. You're a professor of French at Haverford College. Your comments have been directed principally up to this point to the individual, that is the single mind. Tell me about comedy as in its social manifestations. I remember, there's one theory, for example, that that comedy represents a series of norms from which we deviate, to which we return. Is this part of your investigation?
Yes. As we discussed in our earlier talk, The investigation of laughter involves you in a number of fields, sociology, anthropology, psychology, among them. The dimension of laughter that particularly exercises the sociologists, for instance, is the fact that laughter is a binder. And that the public at a comedy is invited to a kind of unison.
It's a participation.
A participation and, if you will, a confirmation of values held in common. So that's very much a feature of the two-headed phenomenon, the two-faced phenomenon of laughter, which is both a solvent, a dissolvent of values. You laugh at things, sometimes at things that you value or people that you respect. The worst that can occur to one, death, mutilation, horror, can also be mentally overcome, can be experienced in the modality of the comic, in the modality of laughter, which does not render us invulnerable, but at any rate gives us a handle and a way to grasp and not to be destroyed.
So here's where the word faith connects to the word comedy. When we look at as I said, very serious issues through the prism of laughter or comedy.
Yes, let me give you an example. My favorite example of humor, of British humor, during the bombing of London in the Second World War. The businesses that had been affected by the bombing would post in the window a sign saying open as usual. In the case of one particular shop, which was practically smashed to smithereens, the owner put on the front window more open than usual.
Here is an open-minded person, absolutely. Marcel Gutworth, we're talking about your investigations into comedy. At the risk of, taking you off the path a little bit, let me tell you about an example of comedy here that that is unusual, if not unique. Norman Cousins, who is the editor of Saturday Review, experienced a debilitating disease and tells the story about going through a series of, comic events. He watched old Charlie Chaplin movies and Buster Keaton, things like that, and makes the claim that apparently some of the physicians are supporting that this had some therapeutic, if not rehabilitative, effect on him. Does that kind of thing enter into your deliberations at all?
Indeed. I read Norman Cousins' account, and one of the features of laughter that I must think about is the therapeutic aspect. Essentially, laughter bathes in the aura of euphoria. And Cousins's point of departure is that since dysphoria, feeling bad, has psychosomatic effects, has effects on your health, feeling good may have positive effects on your health. And that's a sort of common sense attitude, which is shared by some physicians. I don't know that there is a lot of hard evidence, but his own case is, of course, spectacular. Mm-hmm. And there is no reason there's really no reason to reject it out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Marcel Gutworth, we're talking about your investigation into comedy, comic wisdom. Let's conclude our conversation. What would you tell a general audience about a theory of laughter? Why is it important that people, may I be impertinent, sort of discuss the obvious, the things that they laugh at? Why do you do this?
Yeah, it's interesting that precisely what you call the obvious is what, first of all, is most challenging. Uh-huh. And there is nothing more difficult to resolve than what seems to go without saying. St. Augustine, if I recall, said, I know what time is until somebody asks me. I think I know. And the same is true with laughter. But what is even truer is that one resists interfering with one's pleasure. Uh-huh. And that it really, you have to force yourself to look at it theoretically. And in fact, you find a certain hostility to the phenomenon. One would like that not to be a subject of investigation. But as far back as Aristotle, the human being has been defined as the laughing animal. Mm-hmm. Laughter is, and smiling are specific to our species and are integral to our self-understanding. It is therefore too important a dimension of humanity, of what it is to be human, to leave uninvestigated.
Marcel Gutworth is a professor of French at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Marcel Gutworth worked on a forthcoming book about theories and functions of comedy. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings with Madeline Gutworth and Marcel Gutworth, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, excerpts from two conversations about aspects of recent American scientific and political history. My guests will be Hedley Donovan, former editor-in-chief at Time Magazine, Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and James Ebert, president of the Carnegie Institution. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for excerpts from conversations with two scholars at the center. Madeline Gutworth of Westchester University discusses her book about women, art, and society during the French Revolution. Marcel Gutworth of Haverford College outlines his study about theories and functions of comedy and laughter. Women and the Revolution and Comic Wisdom, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.